Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm a Senior Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Rob West, Partner Oil Energy Research at Redburn and also a Research Associate at the OIES to discuss his recent paper, Energy Transition, Uncertainty and the Implications of Change in Risk Preferences of Fossil Fuel Investors, which he jointly authored with Bassam Fatou, Director of the OIES, and Ramat Poudine, who is a Lead Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. Rob, great to see you again. Really nice to see you. Now, why don't we start talking? Your paper starts with the statement that energy transition risk is often viewed as a long-term risk, the impacts of which will not be felt for decades to come. However, this view is an imprecise presentation of reality. Why do you make this statement?
Yeah, so we are going through an energy transition, and what I think we mean by that is this ramp up of renewables from below 2% of all of the world's energy demand to something higher, hopefully around 50%
towards
late in the century.
Yes.
And at the same time, fossil fuels going from about 80% of all the world's energy demand to something lower, probably around 40% by late in the century.
So there's still a place for fossil fuels, yes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But as part of that, there's some assumption about how fossil fuels relinquishes share of the mix, right? And so the idea is that sometime when the time is right, the demand for fossil fuels is going to go down, and the fossil fuel industry will calmly and gradually scale back its share of supply, and everything will work out.
Right.
The thing that's got me a bit worried is that it might not work out. So our study is really looking at some evidence for underinvestment in fossil fuels happening much sooner than this multi-decade energy transition that we're seeing.
Yeah.
And it's really because these fears about the energy transition are starting to constrain investment in fossil fuels.
And that's certainly going to have, I think, so what you're saying, therefore, is that the whole energy transition is going to have this impact in various forms, which includes investment and operational decisions by market participants. You know, but have there been any practical examples of this to date?
Yeah, so I think we're living through one, which is this euphoria around dividends and buybacks in the fossil fuel industry.
Right.
So let me explain that a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, if I think back to 2013, 2014, fossil fuel industry, oil and gas, actually, is investing almost $1 trillion a year amongst the largest listed companies. And if we look at what's happening right now, it's closer to $600 billion per year.
Okay.
And that's fine because we've had lots of incredible deflation coming through the system, catalyzed by these new technologies. But what's going to happen from here is, if you look at the largest 40 listed oil and gas companies, they're on course to make $200 billion of free cash flow this year. And the question that raises, what should they do with that free cash flow?
Yeah.
Right? And really the answer that is most popular in the market is give more of it back.
Right.
So, more dividends, more buybacks, and if you kind of propose doing otherwise and raising capex from this baseline we're at, then you know it's a really good way to alienate yourself with shareholders. But that really prompts this question, which is that the right amount of capital going in?
Yes.
And then you get into all sorts of philosophical questions about what defines the right amount of capital. But I think like you could define it like this. You could say, if you have a project that earns economic return, you should invest in that project.
You should do.
And that's what the textbooks would say. But here's the thing. It's not happening. It's not happening because capital costs are being elevated by these fears over the energy transition. So what do I mean by that? And should we go into how we measured that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, why don't we do that? Why do we have that discussion now rather than raising it later? Yeah.
Okay. So given this context, I started asking investors last year.
Right.
Okay. Dividends, great. Buybacks, good.
Yeah.
But what would it take? What would it take for you to genuinely prefer reinvestment, like more capital going into these businesses rather than just ever greater distributions? And the first thing that happens is you get some sort of strange looks when you ask that question. Why would you want anything other than more dividends?
Because you want to grow the pie. Ah. Otherwise, the pie is going to get smaller, isn't it?
Right. So that's got one of the rationales there. And so you kind of take it a bit further and say, no, I'm serious. Like, what would the hurdle rate have to be? Like,
yeah.
What base case IRR would you want where you would say, okay, take this capital, don't give it back to me, redeploy it.
Yes.
And then I started tabulating the responses I would get to that. And this is really the crux of this work.
Right.
So you get this waterfall of answers. When you're talking about a renewables project, wind or solar, investors saying, okay, so if the return is double digits, I am happy putting my capital there.
Right.
And we can just about do that if we put some leverage into the projects. But that's really the cheapest form of energy to finance, and for very good reason as part of this energy transition.
Yep, yep.
So we're happy with that.
We're happy with that, okay.
Then we get to LNG or gas.
Right.
And that's the next highest hurdle rate. And people say, if I can get sort of 13-14%, I'm really happy to finance a long-run gas project.
Right.
And that's a little bit higher than I've always assumed in all my models,
but
that's still pretty reasonable.
But I'm sure that there are quite a few governments who would think 13-14% is far too high for the commercialization of their resources.
Yeah, so we should talk about that.
Yes.
And we will get there.
Let's get there. Okay, sorry, I'm butting.
Now we come on to oil.
Oil, right? Yes.
So
yes.
Capital costs have become higher for oil than for gas.
Right.
And the cheapest form of oil to finance is shale oil.
Right.
Where people say, if I can get 14-15%, I'm happy. Mm-hmm. And say, well, why? And say, well, because it pays back very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know, you know, within 10 years, I probably made a 3x cash on cash return on my investment.
Yeah, right. Okay. Right.
And then you get to long cycle oil projects like deep water and kind of conventional projects coming through the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And then the numbers are closer to 20%.
Yeah.
20% as a hurdle rate to get new capital into these projects.
Yes.
And that scares me a little bit, and we'll come to it.
We'll
but
come
just
to that,
get to the last bar on the chart, which is coal.
Yes.
And you ask investors, so you know, what hurdle rate do you need to finance a new coal project? And a third of all the investors said, well, no.
Yeah.
I will never finance a new coal project.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if the returns are 1,000,000%, whatever that means, I will not put any more money into coal. Yeah. It's part of this 800 institutions and $6 trillion of capital that said they're going to divest.
Yeah.
And really, this is the crux of the paper, is exploring what does that mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'll think about it this way, right? As a sort of nerdy guy who goes around modeling projects, I've always modeled projects assuming a 10% hurdle rate.
Right.
These are giant capital intensive projects. And if you take the cost of capital from 10% to 20% in oil, your marginal cost goes from $40 a barrel to about $80 a barrel.
Yes.
And if you take your cost of capital in coal from 10% to 40%, you can make a case for $200 coal. And so, like, we definitely want to see an energy transition over the coming decades. But what's really started to worry me from this capital analysis is that we might underinvest too much, too hard, too soon, and get some big energy price spikes that actually derail the energy transition.
Well, let's come to that in a minute. I just want to step back to some of the theory and ask a couple of things. First of all, you know, you're using internal rates of return as a hurdle rate. So I want to just challenge with you and say, is that the right indicator to use? Okay. And secondly, some of the numbers you're talking about on IRRs are very high. And I'm just wondering whether the investors are being too conservative in asking for these type of returns.
I think each investor has got their own prerogative to say what's the right cost of capital for them.
Mm.
What certainly does seem to be the case is that, you know, when I was speaking with these investors and asking them, so, you know, why is that the right number for you, 20% for oil?
Yeah.
You know, really, what a lot of people were citing is, you know, this is a project that needs to wait 20 years to both repay the capital that goes into it, and the cost of that capital. And even then, only after 20 years do we start thinking about genuine economic value creation.
Right. So it's so very long term. It's a very long term.
And so they're saying, look, look at what's happening in the world.
Mm-hmm.
In Germany, the regulator is telling a coal company, you're not allowed to produce this asset.
No, you're not, no.
They're actually saying, you're not allowed to scale up or keep this asset at capacity. Yeah. And so as an investor, if I'm thinking about opening my wallet for a 20, 30 year project, how do I know that I'm going to be allowed to run in 20 or 30 years. And that's a natural reason to require a higher risk premium.
Yeah. So therefore, so you think the risk premium, the high risk premium is right, and you don't think, therefore, investors are being conservative?
It all becomes wonderfully circular.
Okay, well, let me come back to this, because your paper refers to the paradox that in the past year, that some of the largest international oil companies, the majors, have raised medium-term debt at low single-digit interest rates, while the survey that you carried out identifies that the hurdle rate for new international oil and gas projects is being stated closer to 20%. So is that paradox manageable?
Yeah, it's... I hope so.
So too.
I think if you look at the debt, a lot of it tends to be refinancing. But really, across the group, what we've seen is debt levels coming down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's consistent with this idea that new capital mm-hmm. is struggling to find its way into the energy industry. And so that's kind of how I'd square that circle.
That's interesting. Just for those, if you haven't read the paper, for those listening to this podcast, do, because you know the whole detail, all the details of the survey are absolutely fascinating. I must admit, I do recommend people to read it. But look, I'd like to talk, if I can, about the different risk profiles of the different sources of energy, because you've alluded to that. You know, wind, solar, LNG, US shale, deep water, and also mega project and coal. Can you give us some reasoning about this kind of, you know, you mentioned it about the kind of different risk profiles, because I think this is ultimately the crux of it, isn't it? You know, you said coal is a huge risk that you might invest in this plant and you may not be able to use it. So can you give us some risk profiles on that?
Yeah, so I think that this is what really comes out in the correlations in the data, but you know, the perceived risk profile is higher for dirtier forms of energy. It's highest for coal.
Uh-huh.
It's high for long life oil. It's shorter for shale because it pays back quickly.
Yeah.
It's lower for gas because it's the cleanest fossil fuel. And it's lowest of all for green energy because it's green.
But what I think, surely hurdle rates, you know, also will vary by company, and also their risk appetite and their growth strategies. So are there some companies who will be willing to accept a lower hurdle rate than the ones which you're identifying in your paper?
Well, I think
simply because they want to grow.
I think like one of the things that really fascinates me from a capital budgeting perspective
mm-hmm.
is the way some of these companies are setting their budgets. So, I mean, let's take a unnamed oil major
mm-hmm.
where they might say, all right, our capital budget this year is $15 billion.
Right.
Why is it $15 billion? Because it was $15 billion last year.
Yeah.
Okay, but what if you do all of that 15 and then you find some incremental opportunities that create a lot of value and produce energy that the world needs,
mm-hmm.
but it require raising your CapEx?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think part of the answer is, yeah, so we're not going to do that, and that's discipline. But if you think about it from a textbook perspective, you know, discipline is having a hurdle rate and saying projects that beat this hurdle rate are projects I'm going to invest in.
Yeah, but
if I need to raise capital to do that.
But I'll tell you, because a lot of these companies are, you know, the capital employed is critical, and the return on capital employed is a key indicator for them and their investors. So surely you've got to limit the amount you're going to invest, haven't you?
I think so. And I think there's always a danger of these things are really complex.
Right.
But when it comes to what's the right level and is enough capital going in, like my sense is I'm a little bit worried. So yeah, we've got very, very bullish growth numbers for shale. We're super bullish on shale technology from all the work we've done.
Right.
So I think shale can grow 2.5-3 million barrels a day per year
mm-hmm.
by the early, mid-2020s.
Right.
And even shale maniac Rob with his big shale forecasts, like even I am coming in undersupplied when I try and do a 2023 oil market balance.
Right.
I'm not even getting close. And that's assuming we don't have a downturn in the meantime that restricts more investment. And so it's just, you know, I think you have to take a long-term view on this.
Mm-hmm.
Where we're sitting today, oil's at 55, the market's balanced, everything's okay. But these are 5-year investment cycles, and we're still seeing big projects coming on from the peak of the last oil price cycle. It's when you start to get into 2022, 2023, and there's really more of a paucity of project startups that we could see the implications of this current period of underinvestment. And that's one of the reasons for flagging this now.
But that isn't that always been the same in the energy business, the boom bust of large capital investment businesses?
Yeah, I think that's where we get into some interesting analogies. Mm. So I made this comment earlier in our discussion, but yeah. I think really one of the biggest dangers for the energy transition right now is that we might see big underinvestment.
And you specifically talked about coal, didn't you, as your example there?
Coal and oil,
yeah. And oil. But are there any other analogies you could
learn? Here's what would worry me as a advocate for energy transition, mm-hmm. is if we underinvest now and we get big price spikes in 2022 and 2023, mm. how is that going to affect the attitude towards the energy transition? If we're seeing really big price spikes in the middle of the 2020s, could it actually be negative for the energy transition because people would say, actually we need a really big shift back towards coal and oil, and look at all the problems caused by high energy prices.
Yes.
And there is an analogy for that. Whenever we talk, we always get into my sort of obsession with industrial history.
Yeah. And we had that in the last podcast, I remember discussion.
Well, watch out, it's coming back. For me, the analogy that really intrigues me is around prohibition.
Right.
Okay, so bear with me.
I am, please, and so are our listeners.
Well, also, I mean, prohibition is this thing that rears its head throughout American history, mm-hmm. Going all the way back to the sort of founding fathers and the whiskey rebellions in Pennsylvania in 1791 when you tried to put in a whiskey tax,
yeah.
and it might remind some people of diesel tax issues going on today.
Yeah.
But let's park that. Mm. By 1920. It's kind of gathered the political will to ban alcohol,
right?
And again, a little bit similar to some of these bans on coal and restrictions on investing in fossil fuels that regulators in places like California are talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens during prohibition? Well actually, this is where it gets really interesting. You ban the supply, and so price goes up. And the price of beer goes up by 7x during prohibition. What happens to demand? It only falls by about 20-30%.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's with a 7x increase in price.
Yes.
And so then you get all these unintended consequences from very, very high energy prices, like people going blind from drinking moonshine and the mob. Mm. And by 1933, it's kind of clear this experiment didn't work out so well.
Yes.
And they have this big backtracking where today prohibition just seems like a ludicrous chapter in American history.
Going back to the energy, are you saying therefore we're going to find a backtrack in the future?
Well, look, I think back to coal. The danger is very real that if we underinvest in oil and coal,
mm-hmm.
and as a result we get very high oil and coal prices in the 2020s,
mm-hmm.
and as a result we have bad consequences for the world,
mm-hmm.
People might say, well, maybe we should step up our use of coal and oil because we need them.
Yeah.
And so it could actually end up being counterproductive for the cause of energy transition. And so think about that just in the context of a billion people in the world have no access to electricity.
Exactly.
Or 2 billion people have no access to clean cooking fuels.
Yeah.
And just the fact that, from 8 billion people in the world today, there's only a billion cars, right?
Yeah.
Arguably, multiple billions do not have access to modern mobility. But when you add up light, heat, electricity, commerce, agriculture, all these things where energy is crucial, and you think about the risks of scaling back the availability of energy, there could be some really negative consequences if we underinvest in energy as well as if we overinvest in it.
This is an interesting, fascinating counterview, and I'd like to actually bring you to one of the charts in your excellent paper, which is the chart oil supply cost curve and demand under various climate scenarios. And that shows that there's a huge difference between oil demand at 1.75 degrees versus 2.7 degrees under the IEA's new policy scenario. Can you explain the implications of this? Because I think it's a really interesting chart that.
Yeah, well, I would think about it like this, which is that if we do not curtail the use of fossil fuels,
right,
we will have warming.
But you just said we can't curtail it because we've got to keep investments in coal and oil.
Yeah. If we curtail it too quickly,
okay, all right, yeah,
we will have price spikes.
Right.
And what we need to do is we need to navigate the course between scaling back the supplies of this commodity at the same pace as we scale back the demand for the commodity. It's no good if you scale back supply way, way, way too quickly, because then you get big price spikes.
Yes, exactly.
It's no good if you scale back supply way, way, way too slowly, because then you get warming.
Yeah.
And what we have to do is walk that path.
So we've got to manage that path.
Yeah, and so I think...
So who should do that? Should that be regulators or should that be companies? And how will the energy transition risk, therefore, affect the business strategy of oil and gas companies?
Yeah, I think it should be consumers.
Consumers?
Yeah, I think if consumers want to consume less energy, consume cleaner energy, that is on consumers to find ways to consume cleaner energy. And so...
But consumers may have to pay more, mightn't they?
Yeah, and that'd probably be one of the mechanisms. Mm. But really, look, I mean, it's not my job as a commodity analyst to make normative or moral judgments.
Mm-hmm.
It's my job as a commodity analyst to try and figure out what's happening with the commodity.
Okay.
And I think from that perspective, I just feel I'm on much safer ground if I hug my previous studies of what the history tells you.
Yeah.
And so one thing I'd love to talk about is the history of whale oil.
Right.
Right? So here's a good example where you could scale back the demand and the supply of a commodity at a relatively comparable pace. And that's what we've got to do.
Yeah.
But you know, really, and this is very important, when oil came and replaced whale oil in lighting,
mm-hmm.
supply didn't go to zero.
No.
It took 20 years for supply to fall by 2/3. And prices remained 20 times higher than oil.
Yes.
Throughout that time, and actually outperformed other industrial commodities.
Mm-hmm.
And really the point of raising that is just to show it's a very sensitive balance
yeah.
where demand is going to slow,
mm-hmm.
supply has to slow at the same pace, but if it slows faster, you will see prices going up.
I think it's managed, but it all comes back to the energy transition, doesn't it? And, you know, the conclusions from the paper, I have to say, I find rather worrying in that the uncertainty over the whole energy transition and the pace of it and the supply-demand balance which we've talked about will drive companies potentially towards lower-risk strategies. And that could lead to less investment in low-cycle projects and more focus on shorter-term projects with shorter payback periods as a way of managing risks. And that actually is very counter to the structure of the business which we've got today. So
yeah.
I wanted to know, what are the implications as a kind of final word on this?
Yeah, so I think short cycle projects are going to continue to grow in scope and in import throughout the industry.
Mm-hmm.
But it comes back to that question, can short cycle do enough?
Yeah.
And if we ramp up all of this short cycle investment, I still think, I mentioned those numbers of 2.5 to 3 million barrels a day of short cycle growth.
Yeah.
I still think a lot of people in the industry would find those very, very challenging
yes.
numbers to meet.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the danger here is that, you know, if we rely a lot on the short cycle
mm-hmm.
and neglect the long cycle, there could be periods when the short cycle just isn't enough.
Yes.
And really, that's the big question mark when we look out to 2022 or 2023.
And also that leads, we've spent a lot of our discussion today talking about price volatility. I imagine that would be greater price volatility if we go down this path, wouldn't it?
Yeah, fear so.
Fear so. Well, on that note, well, Rob, you know, thank you very much for your time. As always, I've really enjoyed our conversation. And that builds upon your jointly authored paper, Energy Transition Uncertainty and the Implications of Change in the Risk Preferences of Fossil Fuel Investors. Great name, I have to say. And that can be found at our website, oxfordenergy.org, where you'll find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast like I have, actually recording it. And thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you.